Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We are joined now by Dr. Brianna Pobner, who is a paleoanthropologist. She's science outreach and education program specialist for the Smithsonian Human Origins Program, and she's involved from start to finish in creating the new Hall of Human Origins and this article that was in Smithsonian Magazine this month that got us excited about this project talked about the hominids, who we are, where we came from, we're looking forward to checking out that exhibit ourselves and know that many of the things on exhibit there were actually made here in Baltimore. And Dr. Brianna Pobner, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Sorry we had to start a little late, but we had to finish that other segment.
Sure, no problem.
And the number here is 410-319-8888 for you all to join in this conversation. This is the stuff that was in the article in the Smithsonian article. It's really kind of – it's amazing how much we are learning in this period about the origins of humankind and being able to go back 7 million years ago, from 3 to 7 million years ago, to really find things that we didn't know 40 years ago at all, and how we're kind of inching into figuring out who we are and where we came from.
Well, it's fantastic. I mean, and I tell people that if we were even trying to put this exhibit together 10 or 15 years ago, it would have looked very different, because in the last decade or decade and a half, we realize that the human family tree goes back to about 6 or 7 million years ago, and that's about twice as deep in prehistory as we thought. And the number of species on the family tree has just about doubled in that same time period. So it's a really exciting time in paleoanthropology.
So talk a bit about, I mean, the definition of this debate of what we mean by hominid, and
right,
who and the many species that have made up that over the millions of years.
Sure. So the scientific community in the past, I'd say 5 years or so, has really changed from hominid to hominin in the terminology. And when we talk about hominin, we're really talking about all of the species on the human family tree that are more closely related to humans than they are to chimpanzees, who are our closest living relatives. So basically, all the species that evolved since that split from a common ancestor of humans and chimpanzees, which the genetics tell us was sometime between about 6 and 8 million years ago.
So that in this new hall you've created, I'm looking forward next week to driving to D.C. and seeing this new hall for the first time.
Oh, great. That's
wonderful. I can't wait to see it. It's the new Hall of Human Origins. Talk a bit about what you've done there and why it's so unique and different than things that have been done before.
Well, there's two approaches that we took that are really different to other human origins exhibits that have been in other museums. The first is that we really situate, we like to say we put the humans in their place. So one of the main themes of the hall is that we talk about the scientific evidence for human evolution in the context of climate change in the past. So really bringing to the public the idea that humans have evolved in response to climate change, and that it's actually our adaptability to climate change itself, rather than humans being adapted to one specific climate like the African savanna or the ice ages of Europe, that may be a real driver in the evolution of human adaptability, which is this really unique feature of humans. The other thing is that we've organized the evidence for human evolution into a variety of human milestones or characteristics. So instead of taking a really family tree approach where we treat each species individually, we talk about those unique features of humans and the evolution of those characteristics. So whether it's walking upright or using new tools and food, incorporating new food into our diet, changes in social life, the evolution of symbolic behavior. So those are just a few of the characteristics that we have all of this evidence on display for. So it's a little bit of a different way of organizing a human origins exhibit.
So you said something that I want to kind of touch. You didn't really touch on it, but it came close to it, and I want to really talk about it for a moment, because there's a lot of misconception, I think, in our world when we look at where we came from, what our origins are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the way that the research is being done in paleoanthropology and paleobiology now is that we are, from the articles, that we are no longer saying that Homo sapien, that hominins were descended from apes. We're saying something very different.
Well, actually, we are apes, and we are descended from a common ancestor that that led to humans in one branch and led to chimpanzees on the other branch. But I think the major misconception out there is that we evolved from some kind of living ape.
Right.
We evolved from chimpanzees or monkeys or something like that. No, they are our closest living relatives. They're like your cousin. We're sort of way back. You had grandparents or great-grandparents or great-great-grandparents. That was that sort of common ancestor. So it's that extinct ancestor that we evolved from, but not from, you know, we didn't come from a living chimpanzee.
So the discoveries that we were talking about in this article, and the ones that were in the New York Times earlier, just a little bit ago, that are really kind of revolutionary finds, and I want to kind of walk through some of those. The finding of Ardi.
Right. So Ardi, you know, it's interesting. The time period between 4 and 6 million years ago is really one of the most recently researched and sort of undiscovered periods of human evolution, because nobody really thought our tree went back that far 10 or 15 years ago. So an Ardi is a partial skeleton of the species Ardipithecus ramidus that was found. She was originally actually found in 1994 in Ethiopia. And the scientific team took over a decade of careful excavation, preparation, study of the fossils, and then finally publishing them this year to bring this out to the scientific community and the rest of the world. So it's this partial skeleton that has good evidence for being bipedal, for walking upright. The foramen magnum, the hole in the base of the skull that where the spinal cord enters, definitely shows that this female, this individual, was an upright walker. But she also has some really intriguing evidence that, like most other hominins at that time, she's also still climbing trees. So she's and the reason why she's so special is because she is the most complete partial skeleton that has been found that far back in the fossil record. She's about 4.4 million years old.
And the again, it's going to kind of talk for our listeners here about this kind of the evolution of a number of species within hominin that you know, it's really fascinating that you have Homo sapien, that's us, mm-hmm. but then you had living at the same time Neanderthals, the Homo mm-hmm. florensiensis, Heidelbergensis?
Heidelbergensis, yes.
Heidelbergensis. So,
mm-hmm. And that's one of the most. Oh, go ahead.
Go finish. I was just going to say that there are a number of human species mm-hmm. that lived simultaneously near with one another.
Well, and the funny thing is that this is an unusual time, actually, in our evolutionary history, that we are the only species around on Earth. So between 200,000 years ago, when our species evolved, you're right, we were living at the same time as Neanderthals, at the same time as Homo floresiensis, that enigmatic species nicknamed Hobbit that was found in 2003 in Indonesia, and Homo erectus. So the tail end of the longest lived species on our family tree, Homo erectus, they were still around until maybe about 50,000 years ago. And there were a couple other time periods in human evolution and history where there may have been as many as 4 or 5 species living at the same time.
So one of the things that I was reading the article, the arguments over whether or not some of the species that were found were actually hominids, mm-hmm. that even Dr. Potts at your institution, Smithsonian, mm-hmm. questioned whether we say, well, yeah, they may be a hominid, but did they walk erect? We're not sure what they really did yet. Right. Talk about what those arguments mean inside your world.
Well, I mean, the arguments, I like to think of it that when, you know, a group publishes a new species, it's in a sense a hypothesis. They're putting out the first idea of, you know, what the locomotion of this species may have been like, you know, what some of its other adaptations may have been like. And then it's really up to the rest of the paleoanthropological scientific community to take a look at some of that evidence, debate it, and then come up with sort of a general consensus. So, and I think as we get further and further back, in time, towards that split with humans and chimpanzees, it gets a little more dicey to figure out, well, you know, is there very solid evidence that, you know, a particular fossil that represents a certain species really shows upright walking? So
when you find things like Australopithecus afarensis, mm-hmm. Lucy, and her family, that used in the article that was lived around 4 million years ago, 3 million years ago or so. Mm-hmm. That it's clear from you that they began to walk upright at
That's
that
right.
point, right?
Absolutely.
So What are the theories about, and people ask this question often, and people never know how to answer it. What are the theories about what they evolved from? I mean, how did they, when people say, okay, well, tell me then, how did they appear? Where did she come from?
Right. And I mean, the way evolution works, it often works slowly. So, we certainly know that there was a yet undiscovered common ancestor of humans and chimpanzees, and that, Australopithecus afarensis, that species may have, Lucy's species may have evolved from an Ardipithecus species. I think it gets a little more difficult as we go further in the past because we just have less fossil specimens. There's always a plug for, we need to go out and find more discoveries and, piece together the incomplete fossil record. But the more pieces we have, well, the more fun it becomes and the more interesting it becomes and the more we get closer to understanding really what the evolutionary tree looks like.
Now, when we talk about the hominid species, whether we're talking about the Ardipithecus cadaver, that was one of the oldest ones that we know about for sure, or who we are as Homo sapiens, that one of the things that I've been reading about, and it was also in this article in Smithsonian, is what begins to set apart hominids from apes is the idea that the male and female were much closer in stature, and people began to cooperate more to create a different species. I mean, this is a different cultural world. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is one of the clear assumptions we're making.
Yes, and that assumption is based on, actually, Ardipithecus rambidus is very good evidence for that.
And that is, explain who that was.
Right. So Ardi, which is that species we were talking about before, Ardi is a fossil, and she's sort of the representing that species. So they found a number of canine teeth. So in other primates, like in chimpanzees and gorillas, males have these really big canine teeth. And that's usually associated with a big body size difference between males and females. So males are much bigger than females. They have these canine teeth, which they use most of the time just to bluff and to keep their status hierarchy in place, and I'm the dominant male and don't mess with me. Occasionally they will use them in actual fighting. But interestingly, Ardipithecus rambidus is the first species that we have a good enough sample that we know that there are some males and females in there, and they have very similarly sized canine teeth. So it makes us think that their body sizes were also relatively similar. And across primates, a similar male-female body size ratio is usually associated with pair bonding or monogamy, where it's sort of a one male, one female social unit, as opposed to that big body size difference that you see in a lot of other living great apes and other primates, is usually associated with either a single male, multi-female social group or a multi-male, multi-female social group. So it may, I mean, the scientists who wrote the paper say, this may imply that there was basically a different social structure that evolved. And we even know back to 6 million years ago, with Sahelanthropus chadensis, which is one of our earliest human ancestors, that canine size is a little bit smaller than in some of our closest living ape relatives. So there are some hints of some social changes right at the base of the human family tree.
And the time that, and I love the numbers, because we have to think about how long hominids have been on this planet, that we know of anyway, maybe 7 million years ago, perhaps, we think.
Right.
But that the period around 4 million years ago is that, as it was said in the article, is that murky time when that you really are trying to delve into. You're trying to that you think holds the key to who we are.
Well, I certainly think there's a couple of different times. I mean, who we are is, I think, really based on a number of different characteristics or sort of features of being human that evolved at different times. So I do think that walking upright is certainly one of them. That social change is certainly one of them. Some of these characteristics evolve later. So it wasn't until 2.5 million years ago that humans started to make, that early humans or hominids started to make stone tools. And that's another big change in our behavior. So I think depending on what change you're thinking about, they came along at different time periods. So these changes, there wasn't sort of, it didn't happen all at once. There wasn't just, a poof change into humans from our ancestors.
So talk why there was such an excitement about the fossils that the New York Times covered this week that were found in South Africa.
Yeah, so this is Australopithecus sediba, and this is a really interesting species dated to about between 1.78 and 1.95 million years ago. And in fact, I'm currently at a paleoanthropology conference in St. Louis where there were some more presentations on these on these fossils to the rest of the paleoanthropological community. And the interesting thing about this species is that it has a great mosaic of features between things that look like the genus Homo, which is our genus. So there are small, it has small teeth, it has a very human-looking pelvis, but there's other features that make it look very Australopithecus-like, or sort of more primitive features. It has a very small brain, it has very long arms. So there, it's really an interesting mix. And the scientists who discovered this are saying that there are so many features in this Australopithecus species that look like the genus Homo that this actually may be the ancestor of the genus Homo, which led to our species. So the particular fossils are a little too young in the fossil record to be, the ancestors, but certainly the species could have existed far enough back in time. The earliest members of the genus Homo are about 2.3, 2.4 million years old. So it's very intriguing to think, wow, we may have found an ancestor of our genus. And regardless, there is very little postcranial evidence, evidence from the rest of the skeleton besides the cranium, from this time period. So it also is starting to fill in a really big gap in our knowledge about, diversity of early humans. There's a number of species at this time period, but what those early, what the bipedal adaptation was like and what their the male-female body size ratio was like. So it's really, and there are not only the two skeletons that they published, mm-hmm. but they have several other skeletons that they're still excavating out, including an infant. So this was some exciting news that really, got everybody buzzing at the conference.
I imagine it did, and it was. I love the fact that it was stumbled upon by a 9-year-old boy.
Yes, so it's a wonderful story, and I love to use that too. I can't wait to use that in the exhibition to inspire kids. So Lee Berger, who's the scientist that discovered it, he took his 9-year-old son fossil hunting, and a few minutes on the outcrops chasing his dog, and he basically tripped over the clavicle or the collarbone of this early human skeleton. So it's a wonderful story.
So again, I want you to, in the few minutes we have left, at least for my final question, is to kind of again describe for our listeners the uniqueness of and what they're going to find just down the road from the station at the Smithsonian.
Well, one of the things you're going to find that I think we do in this exhibition is we also try to make an emotional connection to some of these ancestors in the past. So we have several full-size bronze reconstructions, bronze statues of different early human species that are touchable, that you can interact with. We have a full-size reconstruction of Lucy, that famous early human fossil from Ethiopia, that is fleshed out. And we have seven different early human or hominin head reconstructions that you can get right up against, and you can press your nose to the glass and look into the eyes of your ancestors. Another great feature that we have in the exhibition is what we call our morphing station. This is a place where you can sit down, have a picture of your face taken, and you can morph into one of several early human species or hominid species, and email that picture back to yourself. And there, every time I have gone into the exhibition, there is a line to get into the morphing station. So
that's true.
That's been great fun.
and I have to say that many of those were made at the New Foundry here in Baltimore City.
Yes.
So it's so when you come from here to there, you're actually seeing some of your friends on exhibit,
that's right.
So to speak.
That has a local connection, exactly.
A very deep local connection. So tell me, and for our listeners to know you a bit more, what are you working on?
So I'm working on, the last four and a half years I've been in the Smithsonian, I've been working on helping to put this exhibition together. So now that it's open, where I'm taking a deep breath, I'm helping with the public programs, I'm helping with our website. So it's humanorigins.si.edu, where we're able to go way beyond what we can even put in the exhibition. My research is on early human diet and the origins of meat eating.
Hmm.
So so this is something that I'm going to continue to study and just try to figure out, some of the circumstances surrounding this huge dietary shift in our evolutionary history about 2.5 million years ago.
We only have like a minute left, but I have to ask you, what are you finding? When did that shift happen?
That shift happened about 2.6 million years ago. It's the time we had the earliest stone tools and the first fossil animal bones with butchery marks on them. So, and big animals. So it's an interesting shift where all of a sudden you're getting this, you know, human access to meat from large animal carcasses.
So that would be Homo sapiens. Someone else started that.
That's right. So that's probably Homo erectus. Well, it's actually probably Homo habilis or one of the early Homo species. So it's a big question of sort of who made that shift.
All right. Well, we're going to have to talk. You definitely have to come back on to talk about that for a bit.
Oh, I'd love to. That's great.
That's great. Brianna Povina, thank you so much for being with us.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
Look forward to seeing your exhibit.
Thanks so much.
Take care.
Take care.
And you can go to our website, steinershow.org, and link to what's going on the Smithsonian and take you and your family down there. Don't forget, the Smithsonian costs no money. Just walk in and learn and enjoy. We're going to take a very brief break. I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's free magazine of ideas and innovation. This April's issue heads to the office with stories about jobs in the city. Features include a look back at Baltimore's past with a portrait of the lives of steelworkers in Sparrows Point during the post-war boom, as well as a conversation with urban development guru Ted Howard, who has a plan for putting Rust Belt cities back to work. Visit www.urbanitebaltimore.com for a complete list of magazine pickup locations. When we come back from this break, we'll be joined by two of our leading environmental activists, Bill McKibben and Mike Tidwell, talking about an event taking place in D.C., but also about the state we're in and what we can do about it. Stay with us. We'll be right back.